I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com.
Who's the author of all this generosity?
Tuttle. Captain Tuttle. That's who, right, Trap?
Captain Tuttle?
I'll have the children at the orphanage write him a thank you letter tomorrow.
Oh, don't do that. He doesn't like anybody to make a fuss.
No. That's right. I mean, he's Mr. Humility.
Captain Humility, actually.
Captain Humility.
Just tell the good captain I'll be praying for him.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lovely lady. Isn't she wasting her prayers on somebody who doesn't exist?
Who doesn't exist?
This Tuttle you made up.
Who says I made him up?
Don't con me. He's a figment of your imagination.
We're back again with investment strategist, actor, and businessman Wayne Rogers, author of the book Make Your Own Rules, A Renegade Guide to Unconventional Success, right here on the TV Time Machine. Wayne, in 1972, you were cast as Captain Trapper John McIntyre on the classic TV series MASH. How did that come about?
Well, like everything else, you know, I was doing independent television shows, you know, bouncing around, doing a movie here and there, that kind of thing, and I wasn't a star of any kind. I mean, I had starring roles, but they were, you know, guest shots in other television shows. I just, in the ordinary course of this, my agent called me and said, you know, they're going to do this thing. Would you do a screen test? And I said, I read the script, and I said, absolutely, I'll do a screen test. So I went and tested for it, and then they called me up and said, you know, you got it.
Now, as we heard in that clip, the first season of MASH featured rather broad comedy, and it really focused more on the hijinks of Trapper and Hawkeye. Now, in later years, the comedy was more nuanced and included more dramatic elements. How did that come about, and did you prefer that approach?
Well, I don't think it was... When I was there, Larry Gelbart wrote most of those scripts.
Right.
And Larry had a... He's one of the quickest... Was. God love him. He was one of the quickest minds I've ever known. Larry had a tendency, because he'd written for Bob Hope and those kind of people, he had to write what I would call sketch material, not to write necessarily longer narratives. And as a result of which, but he and his humor was based on timing to a great extent. I mean, the jokes he wrote had a rhythm to them. And if you didn't get that rhythm, you missed the joke. And so I think a lot of what those earlier scripts and earlier shows were about was searching for that humor or emphasizing that humor. And justified by the fact that this is serious, you're in war, and you are, quote-unquote, saving lives. This is a life and death situation. And juxtaposed against that is the humor, so that you can justify this by saying people go crazy if they are inundated with nothing but tragedy constantly. It's depressing, and you go nuts, the people who are suffering from it. So they deal with it with humor. And in our case, what I would call, quote-unquote, black humor, in the sense that it was had to do with life and death. So, and I think that that serious part that occurred later, I think it drifted in that direction. Why, I don't know.
That's really a good point, what you said, that there's a certain rhythm to Larry Gelbart's comedy, especially the first couple seasons of MASH. The rhythm, the cadence, it kind of reminds me of a Marx Brothers movie.
It's funny you say that. Alan and I once, I think, did, he could do a great Groucho. So Larry wrote in some skit, I don't know how the hell we got to it, where we played the Marx Brothers. actually dressed up. He dressed up as Groucho, and I've forgotten which one. I guess I dressed up as...
Oh, you were Harpo.
I was Harpo, yes.
Yeah, because you had the curly wig.
Yes, yeah. And we had rubber chickens and all of those props. It was a little outlandish and ridiculous. And how he could justify putting that in, I'm not sure. But he found a way. Larry was good about that. He was inventive. He would take some of the stuff that we brought. I once told him a story about a friend of mine who went to the Hong Kong tailor. You know, that was a big thing in those days where your Chinese guy would tour around the country and come and measure you for a business suit. Then they'd go off and make it and then deliver it later, and it was supposed to be fine material and this and that and the other. It was always less expensive than going to an American tailor. I told him about a friend of mine who had ordered a pinstripe suit, and when it came back, the stripes were horizontal instead of vertical.
Right.
And he wrote that into a script.
Right, that's right. I remember that.
Oh, yeah. He was very good at that.
What was it like working for a producer such as Gene Reynolds?
Gene's a wonderful guy, and Gene had an enormous amount of experience, too. You know, Gene was a child actor.
That's right.
So Gene was actually a very good director. He was, I think, a better director than he was a producer. And I don't mean that to knock that. I mean that he has a good eye. He could see, he could tell what was disingenuous and what wasn't. So he had a good eye for the truth, and I think that was his best gift.
Now, you and Alden Alda, who played Hawkeye Pierce, you guys had a special personal and working relationship, as we'll hear Mr. Alda explain in the following clip.
Wayne and I were very close. We got close, we still are close, and got decided to get close. It was very interesting. We're both very serious about trying to do the best work we could. We would rehearse as much as we could. In fact, we both chuckle still about this day we were rehearsing a scene after we had shot it, and after the day's work was over, we stood by the trailer. We were standing in front of the trailer as though the trailer were the camera, and we were playing to the side of the trailer to see if we could get the scene to work, because we didn't think it had quite worked on camera. Now, we were never going to shoot it again. We didn't think that if we got that scene, we could go back and fix it. We just wanted to see if we could do it well.
That's an amazing story.
Well, the truth of that is in the fact that both of us came to the work with the same passion for the work. In other words, not for the results of the work. We didn't care whether we drove up fancy car, or we had the best dressing room, or we were interested in the work itself and not the product of the work, except as it was the work. That is to say, Alan and I were in a situation where we both came from the theater, so we were used to the discipline of a script, and within that discipline, we would try to have fun, naturally, but the having of the fun was doing the work and paying attention to trying to do it always the best possible way. And that's what we would do.
Now, it's been said that McLean Stevenson, who played Colonel Blake, was extremely underrated as a comic actor. Do you feel that way?
Well, McLean, I don't know that he was underrated, because I never would underrate him. I thought he was wonderful.
Yes, me too.
McLean had a... first of all, he had a real comic sense. That is to say, he knew what was funny and what wasn't funny. And he was both funny on the set and off the set. And not necessarily for your benefit. McLean was entertaining himself as much as entertaining somebody else. And once again, he was very gifted. He wrote a couple of those scripts. He had a sense of what made those things work. I don't think McLean, I didn't realize that people thought he was, in any way other than just the best he could be.
Now, Larry Linville played Frank Burns, who was rather buffoonish. How did he feel about playing that type of character?
Larry was very gifted. I don't know in the following sense. I could never have played that part. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you play that part. He was able to invest that character with a sense of truth that this character believed, you know, with great conviction, all the things he said.
Yes.
I'm not sure I could have done that.
Now, one of the best episodes of MASH featuring Trapper was an episode entitled Mail Call. Now, in this scene, fed up with the war, Trapper prepares to go home without the Army's permission.
I'm going to grab a Jeep, drive to Seoul, and catch the first plane home.
Right after they shoot you for desertion, you'll get a ticket for drunk driving.
Let go. I got to see my daughters. Do you know how long it's been since I made love to my wife?
At least one daughter ago. Trap, leaving a war in the middle is very upsetting to those who invited us.
Hey, listen, I don't like a movie. I get up and leave. I don't like the war. I'm going.
Oh, come on, Trap. You got to stick around and see how it ends.
Oh, but it doesn't end. It's continuous. When it finishes here, they take it on the road. I can catch it anytime, any place.
Trap, you'll never make it home.
Lots of guys do. I know one guy shipped himself home in a harp case. That took a lot of pluck.
Now, this scene gives a rare peek into Trapper's personal thoughts, feelings, and viewpoint. Wayne, is this the type of character development that you would have liked to have seen more of on the show?
Well, I think so in the sense that if you're creative, yes, you want to give as many facets to a character as you can. It makes the character richer. If it's credible, if it's believable. And in those situations, as you know, you could almost do anything because there was an insanity to it, so that you could explore all of those various things. Yes, that I would have wished that we had more time and could have done a lot of those.
Now, after three seasons being on MASH, you decided to leave the series. What events led you to that decision?
Well, I didn't have a contract. It was not of my wanting. I would love to have stayed, you know, Jim. I had gotten to the point. You know, when you sign, you know this, I think, about the movie business. When you first get cast in a part, you get what is called a deal memorandum, and that's 4 or 5 pages. It says you're going to play this character of XYZ, and you're going to get so much money a week, and da-da-da-da-da. Then about, maybe a year, sometimes 2 years in this case, later, you get to a contract. And there are all kinds of clauses in that, one of which, for example, was an old-fashioned morals clause. It said, in the eyes of the studio, if you behaved in an immoral fashion, they had the right to suspend you. Well, nobody defined an immoral fashion, as it were, so it was at the whim of whoever ran the studio. So Jack Warner, when he would get upset with Errol Flynn, he would suspend Errol Flynn.
That's right, exactly.
And I don't remember who else. Betty Davis, I think, he had a beef with, and he suspended Betty Davis. So, of course, in those days, those guys they ran the studio with an iron hand, and everybody was subject to those things. Well, there were clauses in this contract that were holdovers from those days, and I said, guys, there's difference in what you're giving me here and what you gave me in the deal memorandum, and some of these things I'm not going to agree to. Well, we're a hit show. If you don't agree, tough. Goodbye. So that's the way it happened.
Now, shortly after MASH, you moved on from The Evils of War to The City of Angels.
This is Los Angeles, one of the least corrupt cities in the United States. And its police force is one of the most honest and efficient in the world. But it wasn't always so.
Wayne, what was the premise of City of Angels, and who were some of the people involved in the show?
Well, it came out of that movie that Jack Nicholson had made.
Chinatown.
Yeah. Chinatown. And it harked back to, you know, those pictures that Humphrey Bogart had made over at Warner Brothers. Sam Spade, those kind of a private eye type of guys that grew out of the 30s. And that's what, and we took a lot of care to try to recreate that era, as it were.
Now, did you enjoy working on City of Angels? Were you looking forward to that show?
I did, and I didn't.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of production was it?
The did part was I loved the character, and the didn't part was the fact that we were rushed. What occurred? This was going to be a mini series, and they shot. I guess it was a 3-hour miniseries, and they shot the first hour, and the network, then NBC, saw the first hour and said, oh, this is a great, let's make this a series. Not a miniseries, not 3 hours, but 13 episodes was always generally the first order. And so they said, let's make this, you know, a series. And the studio came back to me and said, I said, guys, I just got off the boat. I'm not sure I can handle this, you know, right away. And the numbers kept going up, and so they finally hit my number, and I said yes. Now, the production part of that was always we were behind. We could never, scripts were being written as we were shooting, as it were. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember one episode in which we didn't have a script, and we made up a chase. We knew what the script was going to be about, so we made up a chase that opened that particular episode in a fun house, as I recall, down in Long Beach. We shot that. And the director, whose name I've forgotten, who directed that, but he was very inventive, and it looked terrific when we got through cutting it.
I think you said once about City of Angels that was the first show you ever worked on where you actually ran out of night.
That's true. That was true. That was part of the circumstance. We ran out of night. You know, they shoot in Hollywood. They used to shoot in the old days. They would shoot day for night by putting on the lens.
Right.
You'd put a filter on the lens so
right.
you could shoot day and it would look like night.
Right.
I never heard of shooting night to look like day. And therefore, we were there one night shooting night for night, as it were, and all of a sudden the sun is coming up. And so that's what happened. We just always were behind the eight ball. And so the series, I don't think, ever got into the writing, into it, all of the things it could have been.
Well, in 1979, you returned to series television again, this time playing Dr. Charlie Michaels in House Calls.
Yes.
Co-starring Lynn Redgrave as Ann Atkinson, a hospital administrator, and Charlie's love interest.
Yes.
Now, in the following clip, Ann complains to Charlie that watching the Lakers on television is more important to him than her.
We're together, but you're not really with me, are you? Hello? Yeah, you're with the Lakers, or the Dodgers, or the Rams, or the...
The Aztecs.
Yes, exactly. When do we ever talk?
Halftime.
Oh, Charlie.
Why can't I be the center, just for a few hours?
You're right. I'm sorry. Listen, I'll tell you what. The next time that we go out to dinner, I'm going to take you out to one of those nice little French restaurants, okay?
Oh.
You know, with the bistro.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, we'll order souffle, vintage wine, we'll be romantic, soft mm-hmm. lights, some music, an accordion, mm-hmm. a violin.
A dunk shot! Did you see that? Come and sit, hit a dunk shot!
What was your experience like working on House Calls?
Well, that was one I really loved. I enjoyed that show. It was really good, I thought, in the following sense. We had a somewhat kind of a MASH-like formula, in the sense that, once again, I was a doctor, you're saving lives, you can juxtapose humor against something that is serious, so you could have a serious underlying theme, but you could treat it in a comedic fashion. And Lynn Redgrave, who, God bless her, was no longer with us, Lynn Redgrave was wonderful at that. Just she could do things, and you know, she'd been honored several times, and she, as an actress, I mean, and she was very gifted. And so you could write things for her that, you know, ordinarily people couldn't do, but that she could do. And she was dedicated. She was terrific. I enjoyed that very much. There was a guy on there, too, named Ray Bukdanika, who was wonderful. We just had a good time doing that.
And you actually directed a few episodes.
I did. Wrote a couple, directed a couple, yes.
Well, Wayne, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with actor and businessman extraordinaire Wayne Rogers, author of the book Make Your Own Rules, A Renegade Guide to Unconventional Success, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.